Chapter 30. We had not been at it for more than about 5 minutes when the edifice started responding. It was as if a pulse of vitality flowed back into the fronds, causing them to throb and creep, strengthening their hold on the remaining captives. Ramos and I were at risk as well, for the fronds were pushing out feelers which licked and curled around our boots, assessing if we were of interest to the larger organism. This sense of a slow, dangerous awakening extended to larger structures in the room, the pipes and vessels which until now had been little more than obstacles. Vibrations and groaning sounds reached us, and my peripheral vision detected ominous hints of larger movement, a narrowing of passages and squeeze points, not enough, yet, to seriously impede our escape, but threatening to do so if allowed to continue. "We're not even close to getting them free," I said. "We have to work faster."
"No," Ada said. "You'll do more harm than good. Just keep working methodically like good surgeons. I'll take care of the edifice."
"You'll what?"
"I've prepared for this. In a few moments there'll be an event which causes the machine distress. If I've gambled correctly, it'll knock it out cold for long enough for you to complete your work. Slave the suits to your own, and begin your egress."
"I like the way she says gamble, Silas. I am always filled with confidence when I hear that word."
"I agree, Coronel, but I also have faith in Ada. What have you got for us?"
"A distraction. The aversion has made the edifice extraordinarily susceptible to external energy effects. Think about Dupin's mathematical transformation and what it did. We've seen two types of surface patterning on the object."
"Smooth areas and spined areas," I said.
"Yes. Now, wind the aversion back to its starting point. When this machine was made, or spawned, or however it came into existence, it must have had the form of a thick-walled shell. Dupin's analysis allows two possibilities. That the spines were entirely on the outside once, or entirely on the inside. Let's go with the latter. The smooth surface becomes the outer shell of a spacefaring, intelligence-gathering machine, and the spined parts, the towers and battlements of your earlier visions, must be the innards, the cybernetic nervous system. They'd have carpeted the entire inner part, bristling in towards the middle."
I nodded. "And now they're half in, half out."
"Indeed. And imagine how you'd feel if half your nervous system was on the outside of your body."
"A little on the sensitive side."
"Whichever way around the edifice is, inside out or outside in, it's going to feel wrong. Very wrong. And be highly susceptible to external stimuli."
"I take it you have something in mind?"
"Yes."
I could tell that Ada was trying very hard not to sound pleased with herself.
"I've found that small thermonuclear explosions are quite good at paralyzing the machine. Imagine tasering an octopus. It's similar."
"Then it's a pity we didn't bring any small thermonuclear devices with us."
"We did,"
Ramos said, ahead of me.
"And so did Europa. There is the main propulsion core of either ship, of course. But also the service drones and auxiliary boosters. They are common to both mission profiles. The drones contain nuclear fusion cells and so do the boosters. Can these be used for your purposes, Ada?"
"They can, Coronel. I know because I've already used them."
Topolsky was free of his constraints. Ramos was nearly done with Brooker. Satisfied that he could continue without supervision, I moved on to Mortlock, beginning the same slow but meticulous process of alien debridement. "You've generated nuclear explosions?" I asked.
"Relatively small events, but enough to demonstrate the effectiveness of the method. I established control of the drones and used them to tow the boosters to various test positions in the vicinity of the object, then detonated them remotely. There were two possible benefits to this action. I hoped to affect the edifice, and I also hoped there might be a chance of the explosions being detected from orbit. alerting Von Voot to the fact that there are still survivors down here.
I'm guessing that part didn't work, I said.
20 kilometers of ice is a pretty good screen, unless she happened to be passing right over the explosion. I'm afraid I couldn't plan for that. The orbiter will have had to alter its flight path many times since we descended.
And the first part? Weren't you worried about blowing up the whole machine?
That was a concern, but I knew the surrounding water would act as a very efficient force moderator, limiting the amplitude of any shockwaves. Fortunately, the electromagnetic pulse was still of use to me. In fact, that was really the only part that mattered. The explosion was just an annoying side effect.
There was always lightning, I marveled, understanding at last. I could see it now, limning the window panes of a sailing ship, soundless and distant.
My test events, she said proudly. They were intense enough to punch right through the layers of denial and metaphor you hid inside, Silas. You saw them. You just didn't permit yourself to understand them.
Better late than never.
You have kept back some of these boosters and drones?
Ramos asked.
No, they're all used up.
Then we have a difficulty, it would seem.
Only one of magnitude, Coronel. We still have Europa. Just as I was able to establish control of her suit and her drones, I have complete access to her propulsion core. In fact, it's just about to exceed safe fusion limits. Boys?
Yes? We asked.
You might want to close your eyes.
I had no eyes to close, and Ada knew that, but I still braced myself for what was to come. A white flash lit the chamber, and a barely separable instant later there was a rumble, as of a small earthquake, and the room rocked perceptibly. The entire edifice had shuddered against the explosion, perhaps even shifting within its vault of ice. Perhaps even the ice above us had buckled, lifting and relaxing as the explosion's energy passed through it. The light made no sense to me at first, for there were no windows in the chamber. It must have been many dozens or even hundreds of meters to the point where the Demeter party had come inside, an immense labyrinth of narrow spaces and twisting constrictions. But of course the light had filtered in through the nervous system, the averted guts acting as a kind of fiber-optic transmitter. Half the nervous system was outside, and some large fraction of it had been exposed to Ada's explosion, providing a conduit to every other part of the edifice. The movements, the creeping processes I had observed before, were now stilled. Ada?
That should buy us 15 or 20 minutes, Silas. Hopefully enough to get everyone into the water and a good way back to Demeter. Use these minutes well.
Ramos nodded to me and I nodded back. No words now. We just needed to work like demons freeing the others. Or, I thought to myself, at least those that there was any point in freeing. Brooker, Topolsky, Mortlock, and Murgatroyd were soon liberated of their connections. None of their biometric traces had fluctuated during this process, indicating that they were still holding at the same level of comatose brain activity as when I had arrived. Nothing in their suit telemetry indicated that there would be any difficulty in the suits following slaved commands when it was time to move out. While Ramos led the way, they could shuffle after him like a chain of sleepwalkers.
Now to pass, Silas, Ramos said eagerly. We can walk on him in unison. If there is one among us who deserves to be free of this infernal place, it is him.
He made ready to begin the cutting process. I touched my hand to his wrist and gently lowered his arm. I'm sorry, I said softly, but he has to stay. Concern cracked his voice.
You said everyone survived.
It wasn't a lie, but there's a problem with Dupin. A twofold problem, actually. He made to resume work anyway, and I used all the power in my Mark 13 to resist his efforts, no matter how well-intentioned they were.
Silas, this is not like you.
We can't save him, I said, sighing at my own hopelessness. His suit is damaged. Its life support systems were placed in an overload condition, an emergency survival measure. It's not meant to be used for extended periods, and the strain caused a cascade of failures throughout the suit, including its locomotor capability. It can't move, and if it could, it couldn't keep him alive as well. Ramos snarled.
He's alive now.
Just barely. His brain is also very severely damaged. There's enough functionality left in the suit to provide minimal life support function for a few more hours.
Then we move the suit instead of asking it to move itself. We can't carry him between us.
It won't matter, Coronel. Dupin's already beyond any help we can give him aboard Demeter, or anywhere else, for that matter.
The edifice did this to him.
No, Coronel, we did. He stared at me, his sunken eyes brimming with a turmoil and rage I had not detected in him until this moment.
We, Silas.
Not you, friend.
You had better explain. I don't know if you can, but I think you had better try.
We have to leave. The effects of that pulse won't last forever.
We do not leave without a boy.
I seized his arm more tightly, causing him to drop the tool. No matter, we had no use for them now. Raymond Dupin had to die for the rest of you to live. It's as simple as that. I was lost in the edifice. I could only find you if Dupin worked out the geometry of this place. He had to solve the aversion problem if any of you were to make it out. He did it brilliantly. But it was at a cost. His brain function had to be elevated remotely, and each time we did that, it took a little more from him.
No,
Ramos said.
You could not have asked this of him.
We had to, Ada said. You were not there, Coronel, but we were. It was our dilemma, our decision. There was no other way. If Dupin had not agreed to this, you would all still be dying in here.
Better to die than treat another man like something to be burned or thrown away.
Coronel, I said, we must move, voluntarily or otherwise. There was menace in his answer.
Otherwise, Silas?
I can compel you. If those other suits can be slaved to follow yours, then yours can be slaved to follow this Mark 13.
You will not make a puppet of me, Silas. You are better than that.
He regarded me, slowly shaking his head behind the glass.
At least I thought you were. I see now that I was wrong. And I see the coldness that was always there, but I wish I pretended was warmth. You are just another machine, despite everything. You are as bad as this.
His suit is slave to yours now, Ada said. We don't have time for this. None of them have time for it. Coronel, I said, beginning to follow the path that would lead us all out of the chamber. You'll hate me for this, and I understand it. But if I am to save even a single life, Dupin must remain here.
Life is not calculus, you cold-hearted algorithm.
Life might not be, I said, steeling myself against his enmity. But in medicine, we use our energies to help those we can, not those we cannot.
You murdered him.
Dupin chose to save the rest of you. He consented. Hate me by all means, but if you want to honor that boy, you'll do so by saving your own neck. Ada did me a favor then. She turned off the voice link from Coronel Ramos. He followed me in uncomplaining silence, and behind him came the other sleepwalkers I meant to shepherd back to safety and life. Chapter 31. There were two critical parts to the first stage of our exodus: finding a way out of the edifice and navigating the black waters back to Demeter. I could do nothing to improve our chances in either respect, other than to move with maximum haste. I had taken all necessary precautions in freeing the suits from their imprisonment, and none of the telemetric feeds were indicating serious system faults or integrity failures. The suits were in remarkably good condition, considering. The alien machine had not dismantled them, and their functioning was either sufficiently transparent or irrelevant enough for it not to take any further interest in them. It was the warm, soft, fleshy things inside them that had snared its attention. Our ships and suits were good for materials and little else. We reached the water, the limpet-like hydro-lock functioning perfectly. The suits detected the transition to a liquid environment and adjusted their thermal balances, buoyancy control, and locomotor functions accordingly. We swam back beneath the ceiling of ice, moving with the vast, slow grace of belugas. Demeter was still there. There was no need to worry about that. If she had been badly damaged or destroyed in the explosion, there would be no me left to execute within her computer systems. There was darkness ahead of me, an unending sheet of ice above, and then a fuzzy pattern of lights resolved out of the gloom. There was the green, red, and white of the navigation strobes, the amber markers indicating lock positions, and a random blue-white flickering dancing around like fireflies. I had no idea what to make of the latter. I see Demeter, Ada.
Good. Demeter sees you as well. You're about 60 meters out. I'm assigning the suits to multiple hydrolocks so that we can bring everyone in as quickly as possible.
A question?
By all means, you've earned it.
What will happen to me once we're all inside? Lenka's suit helped me find the others and lead them to safety, but there'll be no need for me to have a body once I'm back inside. She sounded surprised at my question.
You won't miss what you never had, Silas.
I'll just be numbers again. Symbols scrolling behind a screen.
That's all you ever were.
I know, but for a little while I dreamed I was something else.
You were just simulating a set of experiences. Our engineers wanted you to understand people so that you could heal them better. If they'd wanted you to treat dogs, you'd have dreamed you were a dog. Probably something small, annoying, and yappy.
I sense you're trying to help here.
I wish there was more I could offer. But at least we're both in this together.
Ramos hates me.
No, he's beyond that. Hate is something humans feel for each other. He doesn't think of you as anything at all anymore.
I pondered her answer. Have you ever considered a career in psychiatry, Ada?
Not to date.
Good. I'd give it a wide berth if I were you.
His feelings don't change what you did, she said.
There was bluntness in her tone, but also something else, something not entirely removed from understanding.
You confronted a truth about yourself that you didn't want to face. In accepting that truth, you were at last able to find a way to save the people under your care. That's not failure, Silas. It's the shouldering of responsibility. It's duty. It's doing the one thing you were made to do.
So much for free will, if I was made to do it.
But you nearly didn't do it. That's the point. You and I were manifestations of a self-generated decision-action dilemma. A battle of wills. The ego versus the superego. The id versus whatever.
You're right, Cody. I'd make a lousy psychiatrist.
But this I know. Somehow or other, you made a choice to do the right thing by your patients.
Except that right thing cost Dupin his life.
There was no other way. Let me stress that for you. There was no other way. If you had a skull, I'd crack that into you.
I do have a skull. It's just not mine. Oh, God, what are we going to do with Lenka Frondel?
Right now, her bones are the least of my worries, Silas. I have the living to look after.
She switched to a businesslike tone.
All right. Locks are open and ready. I have you all on final approach.
Ada?
Yes?
Send Ramos to a different lock. He won't want to be in the same room as me just now. Under my voice, I added, or me him. Demeter swam into full view, and a shiver ran through me. Much had happened while I had been away. The Fronds had extended their hold on her, coiling and wrapping around her hull much more insidiously than I had expected. I suppose you were waiting for the right time to tell me the bad news.
We still have a margin of safety, Silas. The activity quickened after the edifice recovered from the nuclear pulse, but the surface drones are keeping it at bay. How long they can keep doing that, I dare not say. That's why I've already begun the departure protocols.
The drones, there were just three of them left now, were swimming around the hull, using plasma torches on the ends of their robotic arms. That was the random flickering I had seen from 60 meters out. The drones trying to prune the fronds faster than they could grow and consolidate. I swam to the lock she had assigned me, alone with my cargo of bones. Chapter 32. Air flooded the chamber, displacing the water. Biocontamination measures and safety checks cycled, and after an eternity of waiting, the inner door opened. Still operating Lenka's suit, I eased myself out into the familiar environs of the ship. Compared to when I had last seen these panels and readouts, the ship was in a higher state of arousal. The main lighting had come on, and the diagrams and status displays showed a variety of mission-critical systems slowly being brought back to readiness. Main life support, primary power, submarine and trans-ice propulsion systems, in-space motors, all emerging from deep, deliberate slumber. It would have been nice to rush it all, but the ship was a puzzle that needed to be put back together in exactly the right sequence, a step at a time, or the whole thing would collapse. Ada knew this. She was not the ship itself, but like a good administrator, she knew precisely which subordinates to talk to and how to get them to do her bidding. Beyond the windows, blue-white flickering showed the ongoing work of the service drones. That flickering was a little less frequent than before, and I took that to be a welcome indication that the Fronds were loosening their hold on us. Are we all aboard, Ada?
Yes, final locks are just cycling. We'll move the others to safe positions for departure, but for now I see no sense in removing their suits. They still have ample power for life support, mobility if needed, and the biometric feeds are still giving me useful information about their occupants' health. The best we can do now is hope that they're stable. There'll be no possibility of any medical or surgical intervention until we're clear of Europa, and it'll probably have to wait until we've RV'd with the cruise module.
I nodded. I concur. Those suits have done a damn good job keeping their occupants alive until now. They can manage like that for a little longer. You'll alert me the moment anything changes in their feeds?
Of course.
I tilted my head to the nearest window. It looks like we're winning that battle, at least.
I wish. We're down one drone since you were outside. The edifice is surprisingly adaptive. It's realized that it can't take Demeter until it takes the drones, so it's concentrating all its efforts on picking them off one at a time.
Can we still do this?
I think so.
You think?
One problem at a time, Silas.
Noise and motion snagged my attention. A suit was approaching down the lateral access corridor, its enormous form so large it barely fit between the modules on either side. The Mark 13 Fives were bulkier than the 13 I still wore, but those extra layers of insulation and component redundancy had probably made the difference between life and death for the occupants. Ramos reached up and unlatched the pressure release collar under his helmet. He drew the helmet up over his head, which looked even more shrunken in on itself now that it jutted out of the neck ring. He flipped the helmet around and pressed the Velcro patch on its crown against one of the stowage pads on the wall.
You at least allow me the dignity of choosing my own movements now. But what about the others?
Can you hear me? I asked. He glared at me as if the question were insulting.
Your voice comes out of walls just as it always did. The only difference is I know better than to presume that there's a conscience behind it.
You always knew I was a program. He knuckled his glove against the side of his skull, hard enough to make me wince. The suit's power assist was supposed to be clever enough to prevent its wearer inadvertently braining themselves, but sometimes things went wrong.
I knew, yes, until I was carried along in your dreams, or whatever you call them. You were a man. You made me believe a lie while I was in Athene.
Ramos made a spitting motion, but nothing came out.
You deceive me.
If it's any help, I deceived myself as well. He shook his head, disgusted at the sight of me.
You play with us as if we are puppies. Not just jerking our strings, but deciding what we think and dream as well.
I was engineered to have an empathetic faculty. I was meant to identify with my patients, meant to see them as more than just sacks of meat.
So now you blame your creators.
I blame no one and nothing, I said, anger rising in me. Except the nightmare we found ourselves in. I don't even blame Topolsky's lust for fame and fortune that brought us here. He's the product of a system. So are we all.
There is no we. You are not one of us. You were never one of us.
His hand moved to the mission patch, sprayed onto the shoulder of his 13-5.
Vavut, Murgatroyd, Mortlock, Brooke, Dupin, Ramos. Is your name among them?
No.
And you know what you are? Nothing.
I may be nothing, I answered steadfastly. But I still want to do the right thing. None of you are safe just yet. That means I still have executive functions to discharge. You may not like me, Coronel. But your medical well-being is still my responsibility. That doesn't just include treating your brain injury and saving your life, which I did. It means keeping you alive in the here and now, too. His nostrils flared, his lips curling to a sneer. He wanted to strike back, but I had deliberately touched a nerve by reminding him of his debt to me. I was not sorry to have done it.
What are the others?
He snarled. Ada and I will move their suits into the acceleration hammocks. They can stay unconscious until then. It's kinder.
Kindness? You think you understand anything of kindness?
I know for a fact that I once recognized the kindness and compassion of a friend, I said. Ramos made an exasperated, dismissive snort.
Nothing you say has meaning.
Then, slowly becoming aware of our status.
If we are all aboard, why is Demeter not returning to the Exe Fissure? The marine thrusters are not functioning. I know the vibration modes when they are operating.
Coronel Ramos, this is Ada.
He looked around for the faceless voice, disgust creasing the bridge of his nose.
I do not need another one of you pretending to be something you are not.
No, but you probably need the facts. Your operational role is still security fulfillment, I believe.
What of it?
Silas still has his responsibilities, and so do you. His is to ensure the health of the crew. Yours is to maximize the likelihood of mission deliverance. That means getting the survivors back aboard the cruise module, with or without the lander.
For the first time since he had taken off his helmet, I saw something of the old Ramos. Puzzlement denting his brow, the gears of professional concern working behind his eyes.
Why can we not return to orbit in the lander?
Because Demeter isn't going anywhere, dear Coronel. We're stuck fast, and the Frons have just destroyed another service drone. There is one unit left, and I can keep it out of harm's way for the time being, but it won't be enough to stop those Frons wrapping around us and holding us in place.
Ramos looked dumbstruck. I do not think he doubted any part of Ada's summary, for while we might have deceived him about our true natures, there was no possible reason for her to suppress or exaggerate the facts about the mission.
The other ship is gone?
Yes, I said.
then we are finished too. If we cannot leave, then it is only a question of time. We will either die in this ship when its systems break down, or in that water when our suits give out, or the edifice will take us back into itself.
He shuddered, as if at some point in the not-too-distant future, it might even fall upon him to choose between these thoroughly disagreeable deaths.
They tried to warn us, didn't they? There was always that message telling us to leave. Who left it, do you think? The one whose bones you shuffled around? Do you mock me by reminding me of the warnings I failed to heed?
Coronel, I said, trying to reach any part of him that might yet view me with something other than complete contempt. Ada's tactless, but she isn't cruel. She wouldn't have mentioned mission deliverance unless there was a way, and there is a way, isn't there? She kept both of us waiting a fraction longer than was strictly necessary. Perhaps I was wrong about the cruel part in a very small way. If so, it only made me more drawn to her. What was sugar without a little salt to help it along?
Of course there's a way. The fissure's still there. Topolsky's fissure. Between the original impact event and the two ships melting their way down through the entry track left by the edifice, the ice is still highly disorganized and fragmented. It hasn't had anywhere near enough time to heal and reform. That means there's a path. Not an easy one or a short one, but a path. I couldn't send a drone back up it. Too cumbersome, and we'd lose the control signals. But a suit under human control? It's possible. You can climb back up through the fissure, picking your way through the crevices and channels that haven't yet closed up.
It is 20 kilometers to the surface.
Yes,
she said cheerily. Probably more like 40, given the path the fissure takes through the ice. And first, you've got to swim to the exit point. But once you're into the ice, you just have to keep going up.
40 kilometers really isn't too far when you think about it.
Not in this gravity.
It'll just be like a really arduous, punishing ascent of a Himalayan mountain. And you'll have power assist, so it'll be tedious and difficult rather than exhausting. Although, given the time constraints, you probably won't want to sleep, or rest, or stop at any point.
Time constraints.
You have less than 60 hours. In about 56, assuming the standard mission profile, Jennifer von Voot will begin putting the cruise module on its Earth return trajectory. You'll need to be near the surface by then, so your suit transponders have a chance of getting a clear signal to orbit.
And then what? She waves at us before abandoning us to our fate?
You know the emergency contingency protocols as well as anyone, Ada said gently. The cruise module is capable of landing if there's an urgent need. It's not low risk, and the maneuver will affect the fuel budget for the Earth return boost, but it's still feasible. Jennifer von Voot's a stickler, but she's also brave and selfless. She'll do it, but only if she detects your presence.
Ramos looked around as if all he wanted was a familiar human face to address. When that failed, he turned his gaze on my visor. His focus was slippery, as if he preferred to look through or past me rather than acknowledge the corpse behind the glass.
You believe her, that this is the only way?
Yes.
She says 60 hours. Even less than that. It might not be possible.
It is, I said. But only because the man leading the escape party will be the brilliant, brave Coronel Ramos. You'll do it. Every step you make, the other suits will follow blindly. You won't even need to worry about them. Just get yourself out of here and you'll save everyone. He sniffed. He was measuring my words, deciding for himself what he found useful in them and what he could ball up and discard like yesterday's rubbish.
You think you know what I am capable of?
I've shared too many stories with you not to have an opinion of your abilities. He cocked his head upward to the ceiling of ice beyond our hull.
And you? You will also climb through the ice with us?
No, I answered. That won't work. I can only execute on Demeter. Suspicion played on his face.
The signals allowed you to operate a suit from a kilometer away, through the fabric or the edifice.
Yes, that was possible. We can't get a similar signal through the ice. If we could, we'd have already sent word to Von Voot to delay the departure boost. I made a vague, dismissive gesture with Lenka's glove. Oh, if we had time, I'm sure we could rig something up. We could extract enough functioning processor cores from the computer, put them in a cargo pallet or something. I could be dragged up the fissure, a brain in a box. But we don't have that time. There isn't even time to make a backup image of me. I touched a finger to my chest. I've learned a lot since we left Earth, Coronel. That was always part of the plan, that I'd self-educate myself, gaining experience on the job. When we got back, our engineers were going to strip me back to the bare code and suck out all the useful lessons I'd picked up along the way, so the next generation of medical expert systems could be even more useful. I forced a sad, accepting smile. But that won't happen now. None of me will get back to Earth. Not the surgical experience I've gained, not my increased understanding of human psychology, not the friendships I think I've made. Not the songs you taught me, or the stories. Not one of them. He continued measuring me. I had seen his face many times, through many moods, and I think I had learned to detect the tiny slippages that presaged a shift in his thoughts, however tentative. I saw one of those slippages now. An easing in him. Something yielding.
You will not survive?
No. Nor will Ada. We're both tied to Demeter. When it goes down, so do we. And, one way or another, this ship has a very limited future.
You will deactivate yourself before the end?
What was that, I wondered. A flicker of concern for me after everything? But I had to disappoint him. No.
You will die when the ship dies?
He reached for the helmet he had only lately fixed to the wall.
You will die in here?
Not that either, I answered, taking some little pinch of pleasure in his confusion. The dying part, yes. We'll stop executing, but it won't hurt when it happens. And there is more good news. Since Demeter won't have much else to do, Ada and I can co-opt a much bigger portion of the computer core. We can work much faster, taking over resources normally reserved for other systems. However much time we have left, we can stretch it out.
But not indefinitely.
No, I agreed. Not indefinitely. Ramos cradled his helmet between his fingers. He was on the verge of putting it on again. Something stilled him, though. Perhaps it was the thought that this might be the last breath of nearly fresh air he ever drew in before bottling himself back into the suit.
I will lead them, he said. We will survive. However difficult it is, I will find a way. I will get them back to Earth.
I know. I've never had more confidence in another human being.
Another?
A figure of speech, Coronel. Hopefully you will forgive me for it.
I want to think I was wrong about you, Silence.
He paused before settling the helmet back over his neck ring.
You were a friend for a while. If I was mistaken about that, then I was mistaken. But I cannot forget that boy we left behind.
He's my responsibility now, I replied. Some trace of his contempt returned.
You speak of responsibility after we abandon him?
I'm going back in. He was silent, the helmet still suspended. his eyes narrowed, not quite ready to trust me even to the last.
Ian.
Dupin is still alive. His biometric trace is weak, but it's there. I can't save him, can't heal him, can't even bring his body home. I probably can't even talk to him. But I can be with him. I can be by his side as a doctor should be. Ramos held his composure for a long moment, then nodded.
I believe you will do this.
I will.
No part of you will make it back to Earth.
None at all.
But I will remember what you have done, and what you were like. It will not be much, I know.
It will be everything, Coronel. Without answering, he lowered his helmet, latched the seal, and turned his vast back on me, heading for the hydrolock, with the other suits and their human payloads falling into place behind him. I mouthed a silent farewell to my big, brutish friend. It was time for all of us to abandon ship. Faith was an odd thing for a machine to depend on, but in the end, it was all that I had. That ice was still an impenetrable barrier to our signals. Once Ramos and the others were gone, there could be no possible news of their success or failure. I could only assume that Ada's plan was a sound one, and that the suits did indeed have the capability of climbing back to the surface, that Ramos was the man to lead that venture, and that the fates would not be so cruel as to have Jennifer von Voot break orbit sooner than expected, so that there was no chance of making that daring landing. So, yes, all that remained was faith, and I decided to accept its sufficiency. Let it be enough. Let it be ordained that Ramos and the others would indeed make it home. Let there be no doubt about that. I allowed it into myself. Perhaps, because I was just a machine, it was an easier acceptance than for some. I merely had to change some of my internal state parameters to accept one truth over another. Raymond, I asked gently. It's Silas. I'm with you again. I rested my hand against his, wondering if some ghost of that contact still had the means of reaching his mind. Human contact, of a kind. One of us had never really been alive. One of us was dying. But it was still the least that he deserved.
I'm cold, Silas, he whispered. Colder than I was before.
I wish I could help. I can't. All I can do is be here.
You were gone, and then you came back.
Yes.
I can't remember why you left, except that there was something important that I had to help you with.
There was.
Did I do all right, Silas?
You did more than all right. You found the solution.
And it was correct.
It was correct. It was... I hesitated, searching for the right words. Then I remembered what he had said to me. It was beautiful, Raymond. Despite all the ugliness, there was beauty at the end. And you saw it. You saw the beauty before anyone else.
I can still see it,
he said, finding joy even as the lights of his mind began to gutter out.
Oh, Silas, if only you could see it as well. They'll remember me for this, won't they?
I tightened my fingers around his. For a very long time.
I'm glad, he answered.
I'm glad too, Raymond. I stayed with him until the end, as any good doctor would have done. I remained with him until it was over, and the biometric telemetry confirmed that Raymond Dupin had passed into the infinite golden sleep that awaits all mathematicians. He rested. He was peaceful. He would be peaceful forevermore, and I had not let him die alone. I had not been a bad doctor. After that, I realized that I had a final decision to make. It concerned the bones within me. I could bring the suit back to Demeter, or merely relinquish my control of it, leaving Lenka Frondel at peace, providing silent companionship to the strange young man she had never met, and whose name she had likely never known. Dupin was past caring about loneliness, and Frondel was past caring about what we did with her remains. Yet it mattered to me very badly that I did the right thing. The kind thing. The human thing. In truth, it was no decision at all. Chapter 33. The directions I had been given took me on a high, winding road above Plymouth, with the sea at my back. Halfway to my destination, sweating under my garments and the burden of my possessions, I began to regret my parsimony in not taking a coach. But since I expected to live modestly from now on, in the humble role of village doctor, I had thought it best to begin the adaptation to my new circumstances as quickly as possible. The sun prickled the skin on the back of my neck, finding exactly that piece of flesh not already turned ruddy and leathery by my time at sea. I peeled my hat from my scalp and employed it to fan my face. I had taken a wrong turn, I decided. Somewhere in the winding back streets which led up from the harbour, I had wandered awry, despite the simplicity of the instructions given to me. But then it was ahead of me, hemmed in by oaks which obstructed my view of the cottage until the precise moment of my greatest despair. I smiled at my foolishness, wondering how I had ever doubted that I was on the right path. The cottage disclosed itself, opening like a picture in a child's book, and with each faltering step, I wondered if some aspect of it might turn out to be less than perfect, less than suitable for my needs. I had been told it should be fitting, and not too far from the homes of my patients to be, and that it was solidly built and in commendable repair, and commanded a most satisfactory view back to the English Channel. But, being of a naturally sceptical inclination, I had assumed that in one or more respects it would falter, or present a hitherto unsuspected aspect of itself that was at odds with my desires. As I neared the white-painted fence and gate which fronted the cottage, its walls overgrown, yet not too overgrown, with honeysuckle and ivy, I saw not one detail or general feature of the property which was not to my immediate and unconditional liking, and not one thing which contradicted my favourable plans for its future. "I can make myself a home here," I said, grinning through tears of sweat. "It is all that I wished. How lucky you are, Code, to have fallen upon this." But there was a twitch of guilt to dampen my elation, for my good fortune was at the expense of another's ill circumstances. Although I had not even set foot in the cottage, I knew with an instinctive certainty that its insides would be as charming as the exterior, and that I should find no fault with any part of it. No one could live in such a charming abode, so grandly situated above such a fine town as Plymouth, and consent to sell it, unless forced into such action by straitened or tragic circumstances. My happiness, and it was happiness, even so, was purchased on the back of another's misery, and as if in sympathy with my feelings, the sun dipped behind the sky's few clouds, drawing a coolness across my spirits. I opened the gate. I had been told the present owner was at home and would be expecting me.
"Dr. Silas Code?"
She was at the door already. A vision in yellow,
backed by the agreeable darkness of the parlour beyond. There was no negative connotation to the darkness, but rather a welcome intimation of shade in summer and domestic warmth in winter. For a house that is pleasant in one season will often be pleasant in another. I should be alone, of course, except when my patients were visiting, but at least I should be alone in a cottage accommodating to my comforts. After the travails forced upon me by my service on Demeter, I believed myself well-versed in the notion of comfort, and its absence. "Good afternoon to you, ma'am," I said, tipping my wilting hat back onto my head for the express purpose of removing it again. "It is very kind of you to agree to let me visit."
"You are back from the sea, I gather?"
Yes. I hefted one of the boxes with which I had struggled up from the harbour. "They will send my other things by cart when I have an address, but I could not be without my journals, even if I must sleep under a tree with them."
"I hope it will not come to that."
She stepped out into the light of day, the sun peeking back out from the cloud to strike its light across her, as if in beautification. It was the sweat in my eyes, but she seemed to glow and gleam as if hewn from gold itself.
"Your voyage, I trust it was successful?"
I smiled in what I hoped was a modest, self-abashed fashion. "I hope I may have been of some small service."
"Your profession?"
"Assistant surgeon on the fifth-rate sloop Demeter. A modest enough calling, but not without one or two demands."
"And now, they tell me, you shall forsake the sea for the life of a land-loving doctor?"
"That is my intention, ma'am."
"My name is Cossil. You may call me that, or Ada, if you prefer." "I think you will come to prefer Ada in time."
"In time?" I asked, puzzled and bemused.
"I am sorry to disappoint you, Dr. Code. May I call you Silas?"
"You may," I said, doubtfully, and with an awful apprehension welling inside me that this dream was about to be snatched from me no sooner than it had been presented.
"I am widowed, Silas. Believing myself to be on the brink of destitution, I made arrangements to vacate the house. But I was too hasty."
"Hasty?"
"A source of money has come my way by means of a distant branch of the family. A considerable source. I am now a woman of independent means, and want no longer compels me to sell Hilltop Cottage. I shall not be leaving."
I tipped my hat again, preparing to be on my way before the fact of my disappointment showed too plainly in my face. I did not want the least thing to spoil the excellent reversal of fortune experienced by Ada Cossil, not even my sadness that I should likely not see her cottage again, or gaze upon her own fairness. "I am delighted that you shall have the enjoyment of this home for as long as you live, Ada."
"You shall move in with me."
I wondered if I had misheard. It seemed impossible. "I shall move in with you?" she asked sharply.
"You have need of a residence in which to practice your surgery?"
"I do," I said.
"The walk from town is not too disagreeable?"
"It is perfectly fine."
"Then would it disgust you to share a home with me?"
"It would not. Not by any means. But the arrangement is a little unconventional."
"Then we shall embrace the unconventional."
She indicated the gate, over which my hand was still hovering.
"Come inside. I think you will like what I have to show you. There is a view of the sea which some find disappointing, since the sea is visible, but not too visible."
Then, seeing my confusion, my sense that the world was playing some joke upon me, and that I would soon find myself the focus of its mocking cruelty, she made an impatient beckoning gesture with her hand. It was a fine hand, and I wondered if I might soon touch it.
This way, Silas. We have time. Quite a lot of time. But not nearly as much as we might wish. So let us make the most of that which remains.
I delayed for a moment, wishing to remain in that rapture of happiness for as long as possible. Then I followed Ada Cassil into Hilltop Cottage.
This has been a Hachette audio presentation of Eversion, written by Alastair Reynolds, read by Harry Myers, produced by Morrison Ellis for Ladbrokes Studios, post-production by Christian Gates. Eversion is also available in print and as an ebook from Orbit, an imprint of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2022 by Alastair Reynolds. Audio production copyright 2022 by the Orion Publishing Group. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.